Today is Monday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Well, the Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, is very angry today. We've seen 47 migrants allowed to disembark. They were rescued by Sea-Watch, the NGO.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also ahead, Iran's foreign minister suggests that U.S. President Donald Trump try respect instead of issuing threats, and escalating violence in Syria's Idlib province could spiral out of control. It's all on today's International Edition. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif suggested today that U.S. President Donald Trump try respect instead of issuing threats. He was responding to a Twitter post on Sunday in which Trump said, if Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again. Zarif said to Trump, under pressure from a group that includes his national security adviser John Bolton and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is hoping to achieve what other aggressors failed to do. Associated Press reporter Max Small has more.
If Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again. That's what President Trump tweeted after a rocket hit near the U.S. Embassy in Iraq yesterday, and before an interview was broadcast last night on Fox News Channel.
When I first came to office, one of the first meetings I had was at the Pentagon with generals, and they were showing me the Middle East. And they had 14 or 15 sites where there was nothing but war, problems. Every single one of those sites was instigated by Iran.
While no group has so far claimed responsibility for the rocket launch, Iranian officials say their country isn't looking for war. Matt Small, Washington.
Well, Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Salvini threatened possible legal action today after 47 migrants rescued at sea by a humanitarian aid ship landed on the southern Italian island of Lampedusa, despite his explicit ban against them. The German aid group Sea-Watch said the 47 migrants were transferred to a Lampedusa last night with the cooperation of the Coast Guard and financial police. They were among 65 migrants rescued off the coast of Libya last week. Salvini had given permission for 18 migrants, mostly families with young children, to be brought to land on Friday. Salvini reacted angrily to the transfer of the remaining 47, saying on Facebook that if there was a ploy to disembark the migrants, I will take action because that is aiding and abetting human trafficking. Well, I spoke with Josephine McKenna for the latest developments.
Well, the Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, is very angry today. We've seen 47 migrants allowed to disembark. They were rescued by Sea-Watch, the NGO, off the coast of Libya. They've been brought to the southern Italian port of Lampedusa off the coast of Sicily, and they have been allowed to disembark. The Interior Minister claimed to know nothing about it and said that was inappropriate. And as part of that, or as another aspect of this issue, now Sicilian investigators are looking into whether the captain, Arturo Centore, is really guilty of aiding illegal immigration. So once again, we're seeing this very hard line from the Italian government, determined to close the ports to migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean. And now we're seeing two different aspects here, the political aspect and a potential legal action from the judiciary.
In the meantime, where are the migrants right now?
So the migrants have been allowed to disembark in Lampedusa. The boat has been seized by Italian authorities. It's likely to be removed and taken to another port. But right now, the migrants who I understand come from Niger, Mali, South Sudan and Nigeria and other countries have been allowed to disembark and are being processed in Sicily.
He did allow the 18 migrants. And why not the rest of them, though?
Well, all of them now have been allowed to disembark, and I think that's why it's become such a huge issue, because they have been allowed to disembark. Basically, the Interior Minister is suggesting that he did not approve this, and he doesn't want to send a signal that this is acceptable. He's also been tweeting that this government, because of its hard line, has not only had a policy that's resulted in fewer arrivals, he's arguing that this Italian government, because of its hard line, has reduced the number of migrant deaths on the Mediterranean. I'm sure many people find that questionable. But the Italian government's also facing criticism today from the United Nations. Human rights experts from the UN have sent a letter to Italy because they're concerned now that the government is proposing a new security decree in the coming months that looks like proposing fines for NGO ships who are seeking to rescue migrants and refugees at sea.
Also, I understand the Vatican, as well as the Jewish community, is reacting as well.
Yes, at the weekend, the Interior Minister used religious symbols, including a crucifix, during his campaigning for the European elections. The Vatican is furious about this, and Italian bishops have also been expressing concern. And they don't want to see these elections politicized in a way that suggests that the church is allied with one political party over another. And it's also brought to the surface the very real differences between Pope Francis and the Catholic Church and this hardline right-wing government over the issue of migrants and the protection of migrants. As we know, Pope Francis feels very strongly that migrants and refugees should be respected and their human rights should be protected.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. Among the top stories in the world, Sweden issued today a formal request to detain WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is currently jailed in Britain. Egypt's interior ministry said security forces killed 12 suspected militants during raids today near Cairo. And former South African President Jacob Zuma is in court today, fighting to have corruption charges against him dismissed. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
As a young child, you may have been ordered to eat your broccoli because it's good for you. Well, this sage advice is actually based in science. Past studies provided evidence that broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts may play a role in inhibiting the growth of common forms of human cancer. A new study led by Dr. Pier Paolo Pandolfi at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center suggests that a gene called WWP1 produces an enzyme that interferes with the work of a powerful cancer-suppressing gene called PTEN. Working with mice, Dr. Pandolfi and his team found evidence that I3C, a compound found in cruciferous vegetables, can shut down the production of this enzyme that keeps PTEN from doing its job in fighting cancer. The study was published in the journal Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States ambassador to China is visiting Tibet to meet local officials and visit religious and cultural heritage sites. During his visit, Terry Branstad is expected to raise concerns about restrictions on Buddhism and the preservation of Tibet's unique culture and language, according to a statement emailed to members of the media by an embassy spokesman. Branstad began his week-long visit to the Tibetan Autonomous Region and neighboring Qinghai province yesterday. Branstad is the first American envoy to obtain access to the restricted Himalayan region in 4 years. Branstad's predecessor, Max Baucus, visited Tibet in May 2015. Well, a senior United Nations official warns the escalation of hostilities in northern Syria's Idlib province could spiral out of control with disastrous consequences for its 3 million civilian inhabitants. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The recent uptick in violence in Syria's northern Idlib province is causing alarm among UN and international observers. Over the past 2 weeks, at least 100 civilians reportedly have been killed or injured in clashes between Russian-backed Syrian forces and Al-Qaeda-associated rebels. Dozens of medical and health facilities, as well as schools, have been hit by airstrikes, and more than 180,000 people reportedly have fled their homes toward supposedly safer areas. But UN senior humanitarian advisor Najat Rushdie notes there are no safe areas in Idlib. She says nearly 3 million people in the Syrian province are essentially trapped. She says there are no escape routes out of this conflict-ridden area.
The recent loss of life and suffering of civilians in Idlib is absolutely not acceptable. People fleeing because of fear and because of bombing is their cruel daily reality. But now, if the bombing is continuing, where do you want them to flee? They already flee there as like the last resort for them to find a safe place. Where is it that they would be able to go as of now if this is not stopping?
Rushdie says she cannot predict whether the current upsurge of violence in Idlib will turn into a full-blown or bloody war. But she says the United Nations is preparing for what she calls the worst-case scenario.
It will be a real disaster, and a real tragedy if this is really scaling up more than it is now. Not only in terms of impact on the civilian, which is already dramatic in itself, but really in terms of the whole dynamic in the sub-region.
Rushdie says the humanitarian task force, which is responsible for getting aid into besieged and hard-to-reach areas of Syria, is calling for an urgent de-escalation of the situation. She says the parties to the conflict must recommit fully to the ceasefire arrangement of the memorandum signed last September. She calls upon the so-called Astana guarantors, especially Russia and Turkey, to uphold the de-escalation agreement to stop all violence and to prevent further escalation. She urges the United States to lend its weight to this process. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Music Time in Africa is here for you. Hi there, I'm Heather Maxwell. This weekend, tune in and enjoy an exciting hour of Pan-African music from 13 countries. You'll hear everything from classic soukous by Mpilia Bell and Tabule to new releases by veterans and rising stars alike, like Mbalax ambassador Youssou N'Dour and Teta Diana of Rwanda. Song of the Week features Wish Me Well, a song and artist who's riding at the top of the nominees list for this weekend's annual Ghana Music Awards. So don't miss it! Music Time in Africa, this Saturday and Sunday, 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
As U.S. President Donald Trump intensifies his trade battle with China, one of the hardest hit countries could be South Korea. After U.S.-China trade talks broke down, Trump last week raised tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports and threatened to do so with $300 billion more. China retaliated with tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. goods. Asia's fourth largest economy, South Korea, is especially vulnerable to the tariff war because of its reliance on foreign trade, in particular, export to its two biggest trading partners, China and the U.S. To dive deeper into the subject, International Edition Steve Miller spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
Well, it was unexpected, but the first quarter of this year, there was actually a contraction in gross domestic product in South Korea. They have had economic woes, but it wasn't expected to be that bad. I think part of the problem was that China's economy has been suffering, and they're right next door, obviously. And then the other part is that South Korea's economy depends a lot on technology, and in particular, the smartphone industry, which hasn't been doing great lately.
If you take a look at South Korea's economy before this whole U.S.-China trade impasse, is it just the technology sector that was hurting, or were there other factors in play in South Korea?
Well, obviously, South Korea as well as Japan have a very aging society. This is a problem. People are getting old, and the young people can't find jobs. So there were a lot of existing problems before that. But I think the U.S.-China trade war, if you want to call it that, or trade dispute, has sort of exacerbated some of those problems that were already going on.
So it's mainly the U.S.-China situation that is exasperating things. Is there anything else that the U.S.-China trade discussions are affecting in South Korea?
one of the most impacted industries here is the semiconductor industry. South Korea relies on its exports of technology products, in particular semiconductors, memory chips that go into smartphones and computers and things like that. A lot of the semiconductors that they make here go to China, and then they go on from China into smartphones in China. They're assembled in smartphones in China, and then they get sent to the United States. Well, what has happened with the trade war is that Donald Trump has imposed tariffs on a lot of those products, and those smartphones then become more expensive, which means there are not as many smartphones that are going from China to the United States. That, in turn, means that South Korea won't be sending as many semiconductors to China. It's a bit complicated, but the point is they're really sort of feeling the heat of these tariffs, and it's likely to get quite a bit worse in the near future.
So what are they looking at in terms of projections long term?
Well, it's a little bit complicated to say, because while you have seen exports from South Korea take a dive, especially exports to China, what you have seen is that exports from China to the United States have actually increased. And if you look at the tariffed goods, the items on which Donald Trump has placed tariffs, South Korea has been sending more of those to the United States. And it's enough, actually, to make up for the hit they've taken on the decrease of goods sent to China. Essentially, the situation is this. Donald Trump's tariffs on China may sort of shake up the technology production industry so that more goods are manufactured outside of China. Essentially, these companies are deciding that it is too expensive to make things in China. They're going to do so elsewhere. And that could lead to a lot of long-term impact here in Asia.
You know, one of the things when you talk about elections, it's all about the economy and everything is local, local, local. When you are walking the streets of Seoul and you read South Korean media, how are people there looking at the situation?
Well, that is a tricky question, because unlike Hong Kong or something, not a lot of South Koreans have money invested in the stock market. So while the tariffs have resulted in a hit to big companies like Samsung and I think HK Hynix is the big other big semiconductor producer, it's not necessarily hitting the common person in South Korea as it relates to that. However, there are other aspects of the economy, I think, that are hurting the average South Korean. Property prices are very high. The won actually has been performing not very good lately. There are a lot of impacts, and I think that there's a lot of pressure on the government here to be able to make some progress on the economy.
That was International Edition's Steve Miller speaking with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. Well, Australia's centre-right government has staged a stunning comeback in Saturday's federal election, widely predicted to feel the force of voter anger after six turbulent years in office. The Liberal National Coalition will be returned to power for a third term, either in its own right or in a minority government with the support of independents. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This is a remarkable result few people had expected. For months, opinion polls had indicated that Australians had grown tired of feuds within Scott Morrison's Conservative government. It's had three prime ministers since it was elected in 2013, but fought this campaign on its economic record. The prime minister had said the opposition wasn't fit to govern and couldn't manage money. He's celebrating his unexpected triumph with party loyalists and his wife and two daughters.
I have always believed in miracles. I'm standing with the three biggest miracles in my life here tonight. And tonight we've been delivered another one.
Voters appeared unnerved by the opposition's radical tax reform agenda and its big spending plans for health and education. Labour's Bill Shorten has quit as leader and has spoken of the pain of defeat.
I want to say beyond this room to Australians who supported Labor, I know that you're all hurting, and I am too.
It's not all good news for the centre-right coalition. The former Conservative Prime Minister Tony Abbott has lost his seat in Sydney to an independent candidate after holding it for 25 years. Australian politics is rarely dull. It's often brutal and petty, but also unstable. It's more than a decade since a prime minister here last served a full term in office. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Well, Malawians go to the polls tomorrow to choose a new president, members of parliament, and local representatives. Incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika faces a stiff challenge from main opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party. In an interview, President Mutharika tells VOA's Peter Cloti that the administration in the long way would ensure there is no violence surrounding the election, adding that all the contestants are committed to accepting the outcome of the presidential election, irrespective of the winner.
This is a watershed election in the history of this country, because on Tuesday we'll be choosing whether this country should develop for development or whether we should continue with politics as usual. So it's a choice between my going forward, going backwards. That's my message.
So, Mr. President, Tuesday, Malawians go to the polls. There have been issues of politically related violence. What are you saying about it, and how is your government addressing this?
There will be no violence. We are all committed to peaceful elections. As you know, Malawi is a very peaceful country. It's very, very peaceful. People, I was at the rally yesterday, closing rally. There was no single incident of violence. I can assure you that I'm committed to make sure there's no violence. The police and all their security agencies have been empowered to make sure that there's law and order in this country and that there will be no violence. And I can assure you that there will be no violence. It will be a peaceful election, and it will be a credible election and a transparent election.
What is your message to the people of Malawi in terms of ensuring peace and tranquility, in terms of ensuring and giving them confidence that the elections will be free, fair, transparent, and credible, and that whoever wins, Malawians will accept the outcome of these elections?
Yes, well, indeed. We have all committed ourselves to accept the results of the elections. That's why we adopted multi-party democracy in 1993, after dictatorship of the Malawi Congress Party. So we are committed to democracy and freedom. And as I said earlier, all the security services have been given enough resources to make sure that they maintain law and order. That's my message. And you asked me to say, what's the message to Malawi people? It's very simple, that this is very, very important about the future of this country. That on Tuesday they must decide whether this country will go forward or backwards, whether it will be development or politics as usual. They have to decide, look at the agenda, what I've done during the last 5 years, and my promise in our manifesto. And once they do that, I think they'll have no problem deciding that they need to elect me a Democratic Progressive Party.
That was Malawi's incumbent president, Peter Mutharika, speaking with VOA's Peter Cloti. Well, the nearly 400 graduating seniors of Morehouse College in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta received an unexpected generous graduation gift on Sunday. Associated Press reporter Jackie Quinn has more.
Class of 2019, may the sun always shine upon you.
This sunny future, the gift of a lifetime for the class of 2019 at Morehouse College, comes courtesy of billionaire Robert F. Smith, the CEO of Visa Equity Partners.
My family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
For those 400 cheering, now debt-free graduates, it's an estimated $40 million, and all he asks is that they pay it forward.
We are enough to take care of our own community.
Smith received an honorary doctorate from Morehouse, which is an all-male, historically black college located in Atlanta. I'm Jackie Quinn.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA.